Yeah, I wanted to return to the question of the immunity granted by the State Department.
And we are experiencing some technical difficulties with that story. We'll get back to you later on that. Prominent biotech firms Syngenta, Monsanto, and DuPont have put over $600,000 into a Southern Oregon ballot initiative on genetically modified organisms. The transnational corporations are trying to defeat Measure 15-119, which is headed to Jackson County voters on May 20th. The measure would ban genetically engineered crops in Jackson County. Syngenta has had issues in Jackson County before. For the past decade, Syngenta has been planting genetically engineered Swiss chard and beets too close to certified organic locations in Jackson County, including farms and a school garden. The company has been fined but appealed those fines, saying that they could not control the drift of the test organisms.
A cracked support beam at McMenamin's Crystal Ballroom caused the venue to be evacuated during a Schoolboy Q concert last night. About 1,500 concertgoers spilled into Portland streets as police rerouted traffic from the scene. Structural engineers and city inspectors were scheduled to visit the building today and report on the safety of the building. The Crystal Ballroom venue offered refunds for ticket holders.
We return to the Columbia Riverkeeper story with Jenka Soderbergh.
The expansion of oil and gas terminals, as well as the shipment of oil and coal trains through the state of Oregon. What's the status of that, and how is it that this terminal managed to go through after all?
Well, this terminal slipped through under the radar, basically by using the same permits that were needed, that were granted to an ethanol terminal, and just switched their commodity, saying... there's no difference between selling, grain versus flour, so we shouldn't have to change our permits. Well, that's really not the case. That was a huge mistake. There's a huge difference between ethanol and crude oil, and the state just did not flag that, and is now having to go back and rein in this company that has gone rogue entirely, violating their permits by a huge amount.
And I understand that there is another attempt to construct a crude oil terminal in Northwest Portland at the former Paramount Petroleum plant that's also kind of under the radar, but has been exposed recently by the Earth First Journal. And the company involved is ARC Logistics. And I wonder, do you know anything about that proposed crude oil terminal that's being pushed right now here in Portland?
Well, we're very concerned with any proposals for crude oil in the Northwest that would bring more explosive trains through. And we're closely looking into that, but have not come up with a concrete idea of what's actually happening at that terminal site.
Well, we will continue to keep an eye on it here at KBOO Community Radio. Again, that crude oil terminal that's being proposed and permits are on the being applied for right now at the Paramount Petroleum plant in Northwest Portland. And we've been speaking with Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey. She's with Columbia Riverkeeper about the Port Westward oil terminal in Clatskanie that has a public comment period open right now on its proposed oil spill contingency plan, which Columbia Riverkeeper says is insufficient at best, and also a public comment period that is open right now on a proposed permit to expand operations at that oil terminal in Clatskanie, Oregon. This is Jenka Soderbergh with KBOO News.
An investigation of U.S. government contracts with Blackwater found over $1 billion that were not properly accounted for. The U.S. State Department's press secretary participated in a dicey exchange with reporters on the issue late last week. Reporters were inquiring about a federal judge's ruling that the department should be investigated for its decision to grant immunity to Blackwater employees. The ruling stems from a 2007 shooting in Iraq's Nisour Square that left 14 unarmed civilians dead, including 9-year-old Ali Kanani.
Yeah, I wanted to return to the question of the immunity granted mm-hmm. by the State Department to Blackwater employees in Iraq in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Were you able to establish, one, whether you felt that the department had the right to grant immunity at that time, absent the authorization of the Justice Department or the concurrence of the Justice Department?
Well, I'm not going to comment on what people in 2007 thought about a right to grant immunity in Iraq. I will say, to kind of expand a little bit on one of your questions yesterday about what we specifically did to address, we have worked to address immunity concerns that arose soon after Nisour Square, including by creating, in conjunction with DOJ, new warning forms for voluntary interviews and compelled interviews, and emphasizing procedures to follow when using the forms through improved training and notices to overseas posts. So certainly that was part of, among other issues, that we worked to address in conjunction with the Department of Justice.
What does that mean? Does that mean, what do the forms actually do? Do they warn people that anything they say can and will be used against them? Do the forms say to the DS or other investigators, you have no authority to grant immunity without checking with the Justice Department? I mean, it still doesn't, to me, address...
Sure, I'm not sure if these forms are publicly available forms. If they are, I will talk to our team and see if we can make one available, and perhaps we can get you a briefing with them on the specifics.
And why are you not able to address that question of...
About 2007?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like you haven't had enough time to think about it or figure out what happened. So why not address or get somebody who worked on this to address that?
Well, thank you for your advice, Arshad, but I'm not going to speak to what happened 7 years ago in a different administration, and clearly we've taken steps to address this since then, and I think that's the important point we should all focus on.
The trial for the Blackwater employees who killed the Iraqi civilians in 2007 is scheduled to begin in June, now that a second motion to dismiss has been denied.
A bomb which detonated this morning at a bus depot in the outskirts of the Nigerian capital of Abuja has killed 71 people. 124 people were also wounded in the attack. It was the deadliest attack ever carried out in the capital, and authorities suspect it was the work of hardline Islamic extremists Boko Haram. Authorities say a car bomb most likely detonated, leaving a 4-foot-deep hole at the blast center. Nearby cars caught fire and exploded, injuring more people. Nigeria, Africa's most populous and economically prosperous country, has battled Islamic militants who are fighting to establish an Islamic state and have killed thousands in numerous massacres across the country over more than a decade. Boko Haram last attacked Abuja in 2011 when a car bomb hit the United Nations headquarters, killing 26 people.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this broadcast for Ken Jones' interview with Paul Southwick. Mr. Southwick is the lawyer for a transgender George Fox student who attempted to reside in a male-only dorm. At 6, it's Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in Portland is expected to be cloudy with a 20% chance of rain.
It's 5:16, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
No matter how small the haul, a thief is a thief, right? If a poverty wage fast food worker sneaks out a couple of burgers to take home to the kids, the bosses yell, "Thief!" But what do you call it when the bosses steal from those same workers? How about outrageous, disgusting, or simply unbelievable? Well, believe it or not, it's happening every day in multiple ways, and not by a few bad apples, but in what has become routine corporate practice by McDonald's, Burger King, Domino's, and other hugely profitable chains. Technically, it's called wage theft, and it involves such slick-fingered moves as erasing hours from employee time cards, requiring off-the-clock work, not paying for overtime hours, refusing to reimburse workers for gas they bought while making deliveries, or inventing uniform fees and other deductions that illegally drop pay below the minimum wage. Come on, isn't it shameful enough that these global behemoths pay rock-bottom wages without them circling back like low-life pickpockets to steal from their own employees? This is not just corporate thievery, it's thuggery. How low can fast food greed go? So low that the top bosses at headquarters play a sleazy game of hide-and-seek, pretending that they have nothing to do with this ripoff. Personnel practices, they airily claim, are left to local franchisees who are, quote, independent business owners. Bovine excrement. Corporate Central dictates how much mustard each franchise can put on a bun, so to think that it doesn't monitor every dime in payroll is a ludicrous lie. This is Jim Hightower saying, in a recent survey of fast food workers, 9 out of 10 said they have had wages stolen by their bosses. This thievery has become business as usual, and it's worse than shameful. It's slimy. For more information, go to National Employment Law Project at NELP.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
And now this from the Workers' Independent News Network.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
If you don't fight, you will lose. If you fight, you might win, and we've seen a win.
Paul Fleckenstein of the Vermont Workers' Center celebrating a bus driver strike victory in Burlington. Today is the first day since the recent bus strike there that bus riders in Chittenden County, Vermont will be paying to ride the buses again. Buses were free for several days after bus drivers at Teamsters Local 597 won their three-week strike with strong solidarity from the community and from other unions. James Fouts is one of the drivers from Teamsters Local 597.
Two tyrants and 13 board members held this community hostage over their pathetic, petty goals, and it was for no good reason. They ended up compromising and giving us all of the things we wanted from the beginning in general. We compromised for 10 months, and it took 3 weeks of suffering, 3 weeks of pain, 3 weeks of solidarity to convince them that their tyranny would not continue forward. So I want to thank you, everyone.
The Affordable Care Act enrollment has hit more than 7.5 million people. That figure was used in recent days at a congressional hearing by outgoing Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says Sebelius took on one of the toughest jobs in the Obama administration, and her efforts helped give millions of Americans access for the first time to affordable health care. As Sebelius exits, Weingarten says the Affordable Care Act is saving families money and ensuring they can get the treatment they need without battling big insurance companies. The AFT says it is confident that Sylvia Matthews Burwell will build on Secretary Sebelius's work to ensure that high-quality health care is not a luxury to a few, but a promise to all. A union representing federal prison workers is commending the U.S. Sentencing Commission for voting to reduce the sentencing guideline levels applied to most federal drug trafficking offenses. The American Federation of Government Employees and its Council of Prison Locals says federal prisons are overcrowded and understaffed, a dangerous combination. The union says reducing the lengthy drug sentences will lessen overcrowding and improve safety for both prison workers and inmates. AFGE represents 37,000 Bureau of Prisons corrections officers and staff. The union says the number of people in federal prisons has skyrocketed, nearly 900% more prisoners than in 1980. And that's a direct result of harsh drug prison sentences, including mandatory minimums. The modest reductions in sentences approved unanimously by the U.S. Sentencing Commission cut prison sentences by about 5 years. AFGE wants to see more action on changing the mandatory minimum sentences. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A white supremacist and former Ku Klux Klan member is the accused gunman in a deadly shooting yesterday targeting two Jewish community properties in suburban Kansas City, Kansas. The shootings yesterday took the lives of three people. Authorities have yet to release their names. Frazier Glenn Cross, the suspect alleged to have carried out the shootings, was once the leader of a KKK chapter and also ran for national office as the leader of a white supremacist political party. The shootings took place yesterday afternoon at a Jewish community center where children were auditioning for a local talent competition and rehearsing a play, as well as an elder care facility. While some witness accounts indicated that Cross made anti-Semitic remarks as he was arrested, authorities have yet to confirm whether this is the case. It is unknown whether the shootings were meant to coincide with the beginning of the Jewish festival of Passover, which began today.
A Nevada rancher who disagreed with the federal government's roundup of his cattle organized a group of armed vigilantes to confront the Federal Bureau of Land Management at their southern Nevada headquarters. In response, the federal agents backed down and released the cattle they had rounded up. The move created a flurry of controversy online, with critics pointing out that the response of the feds might have been different if the militia group had been black or Native American. 2 years ago, the federal government seized the horses belonging to Western Shoshone elders Carrie and Mary Dan. They were unable to get their horses back despite the fact that they were on unceded Western Shoshone land. In the incident this past weekend, armed vigilantes, including snipers, set up at a highway overpass, forced federal agents from the Bureau of Land Management to retreat and give back the lawfully confiscated cattle. The cattle had been unlawfully grazing on public land since 1993 when their owner began to refuse to pay required grazing fees. Rancher Cliven Bundy got his cattle back after a tense four-hour standoff that shut down Interstate I-5. The BLM stated that it will work through the courts and administratively to find a solution.
And now we go to headlines from Independent Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. People born in the baby boom years are growing older. That means more of them now need additional medical care, especially for chronic diseases. This week, we'll explore aging in Alaska. In the first of four stories, KMBA's Jocelyn Estes reports on the impact of doctor shortages.
Reed Blackwelder is president of the American Academy of Family Physicians and a professor of family medicine at the Quillen College of Medicine in Tennessee. He says the nation is facing a shortage of the doctors who provide basic treatment and decide if a patient needs to see a specialist. He says other countries have recognized the value of primary care.
Most other countries have at least 50% of their physician workforce as being primary care. And this country is right around 30%.
Blackwelder says people without a regular health provider often delay going to the doctor and end up in the emergency room at a later stage in the disease, potentially causing higher risk of complications, higher costs, and even death. However, a five-state program is working to boost the number of doctors in rural areas. WAMI gets its name from the five states it serves: Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. Dr. Ian Van Tetz is co-director of a program in the Alaska WAMI School of Medical Education. He says WAMI seeks students who will return to practice in their home states.
It enables Alaskan students to become doctors, makes it easier for them. And the flip side of that is it makes it more likely for us to have doctors here in Alaska, because instead of recruiting people from outside, we're training people who already live here and want to work here.
Van Tetz says Newsweek names WAMI as one of the most highly rated programs of its kind in the country. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The United Nations expert who investigates and monitors the rights of indigenous peoples urged the Washington football team last week to reconsider use of the term Redskins in the NFL team's name. Special Rapporteur James Anaya acknowledged that there are different opinions on the issue, but said in a statement the term is connected to suffering and does not honor or respect the legacy of Native Americans in the United States. Anaya cited the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which calls for the dignity and diversity of indigenous communities to be reflected in education and public information. Special rapporteurs are appointed by the UN Human Rights Council. The positions are honorary, and the experts are not paid for their work by the UN. The National Congress of American Indians, or NCAI, praised Anaya's statements in a press release. NCAI and the Oneida Nation are running a national campaign called Change the Mascot. Team owner Dan Snyder has said publicly he will not eliminate Redskins from the Washington football team name. The Alaska State Senate voted unanimously over the weekend to set aside a day each year to honor the life of Dr. Walter Sobolov. The Tlingit elder and scholar was also a translator who specialized in traditional oratory and storytelling. The Sealaska Heritage Institute broke ground on a center named for Dr. Sobolov last fall. The center in downtown Juneau will be devoted to the study of Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian cultures. It will include spaces for art and performances. The measure to create Dr. Walter Sobolov Day already passed the Alaska House and is now headed to Governor Sean Parnell, who needs to sign the legislation before it can become law. During this week in 1878, the Sheldon Jackson School was founded in Sitka, Alaska. It was first established as an industrial and training school for Tlingit boys. Later, it became a private four-year college. For National Native News, I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Service.
Authorities searching for the Malaysia Airlines flight missing for more than a month have deployed a submersible robot in hopes of finding the downed flight on the floor of the Indian Ocean. Australian authorities had used a U.S. Navy-supplied black box locator in hopes of finding the flight recorders of the missing 777 jet, which disappeared on March 8, carrying 239 people. The autonomous robot sub, deployed by the Australian Navy, can create three-dimensional maps of the ocean floor using sonar. Over several weeks, passes along the area presumed to be the site of the crash seemed to turn up several signals officials with the intergovernmental agency investigating the crash said were consistent with those sent out by a black box. However, this weekend, authorities said they could no longer detect signals. Black boxes are equipped with batteries which typically broadcast a signal for a month. The last signal was heard 6 days ago. Malaysian authorities announced on March 24th that the flight had most likely crashed into the Indian Ocean, killing everyone on board. Online theories have abounded, including one that has eyewitnesses locating the plane, as well as some wreckage near the U.S. military base of Diego Garcia in the South Pacific Ocean.
In eastern Ukraine, pro-Russian protesters and militias have continued to take over government buildings, as Ukraine's government in Kiev has said it is planning operations to confront them. The Ukrainian government gave a 9 a.m. deadline to protesters who took over a municipal building in the eastern city of Donetsk, ordering them to vacate after more than a week of occupation. The Donetsk protesters have said they plan on taking over critical infrastructure in the region. In other developments, pro-Russian protesters overran a police station in the eastern city of Orlivka, and barricades of roads by pro-Russian separatists in both Donetsk and Slavyansk remain in place. The acting Ukrainian president had signaled that an anti-terror operation was imminent in Slavyansk this morning, although no government action was taken to dislodge protesters there. The acting president fired the state security head in charge of that operation today, according to reports. The United States, who along with Western powers backed the Kiev government, have condemned the recent seizures of government buildings as part of a ploy by Russia to foment discontent in Ukraine. There were reports of Ukrainian military forces and pro-Russian militias clashing over the weekend. Ukraine has suffered popular unrest, which first began in Kiev and spread to the eastern portion of the country after former President Viktor Yanukovych fled the country in February.
About 5,000 people rallied in central Moscow yesterday to protest a crackdown on media coverage of the crisis in Ukraine. The protest was prompted by the removal of a longtime editor of the popular Russian internet news site Lenta.ru. The Kremlin denies charges of censorship or influencing the media. Polls show that most Russians support the annexation of the Crimean Peninsula, and Putin's numbers are up too. The rally was heavily policed and featured speeches from activists criticizing state control of the media, including reference to the country's communist totalitarian past.
The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Sunday released a report that found that nations still have a chance to fulfill the goal of reducing climate change, but must aggressively turn away from relying on fossil fuels, such as coal, for energy and replace them with cleaner energy sources, such as solar and wind power. To reach their target of 3.6 degrees over pre-industrial levels, nations must work together to lower emissions, quote, by 40 to 70% of what they were in 2010, the report said. The report summarizes the best possible science on current and expected impacts of climate change from increased concentrations of atmospheric greenhouse gases. Professor James Dorsey responded to the report by saying that it shows the importance of beginning immediately to limit climate change. Dorsey says that the costs of avoiding disruptive climate change are likely to be high, and the already disadvantaged will continue to suffer the most. If governments take steps to reduce carbon pollution rapidly and immediately, the overall economic damage could be cut in half. The IPCC report confirms that climate change is happening and that no continent, country, or region is immune from the unfolding climate catastrophe.
Late on Friday, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a report with the United Nations Committee Against Torture, documenting the severity of long-term harms suffered by survivors of sexual violence by Catholic clergy. The UN committee is reviewing the Vatican on its compliance with the international prohibitions against torture and other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment under the Convention Against Torture, which the Vatican ratified in 2002. This will be the second time in 4 months that top Catholic officials have been called before the UN to account for the Vatican's human rights record on addressing the ongoing worldwide crisis of sexual violence and cover-ups within the Catholic Church. Vatican representatives will appear before and be questioned by the committee on May 5th and 6th, 2014.
In the latest news from U.S. occupied Afghanistan, a suicide bomber blew himself up in a market on Friday in eastern Afghanistan, killing pro-governmental tribal elder and wounding three civilians, authorities said.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, April 14th, 2014. Israeli troops injure and kidnap a Palestinian young man from southern West Bank, while settlers attack Palestinian workers in the north. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli forces raided Aida refugee camp near the southernmost bank city of Bethlehem late on Sunday and shot and injured, then arrested a Palestinian youth. 20-year-old Hamza Batta was shot by Israeli troops in his leg and abdomen, his family reported. Israeli soldiers then detained him and brought him to Sha'ar Tzedek Medical Center in Jerusalem in critical conditions. No further details were provided. Elsewhere, Israeli troops and a group of settlers attacked on Monday morning Palestinian workers who were constructing agricultural roads in Burin village south of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Settlers threw stones at workers and their bulldozer, while troops fired tear gas at youth who came to the location after the breakout of clashes. Local sources said that the settlers came from the nearby illegal settlement of Bracha. Earlier on Monday, Israeli forces kidnapped a Palestinian from Bethlehem in southern West Bank after raiding and searching his house. In northern West Bank, Israeli forces took a one man to unknown location after raiding his house in Al-Dahya area in Nablus city. In the nearby Jenin, Israeli forces also kidnapped two Palestinians from the province. In other news, Israeli soldiers detained on Monday afternoon a news crew working for the Palestinian state-run Wafa agency at the entrance of Al-Nabi Saleh village near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. The crew were covering the Israeli siege imposed on the village since 3 days. Al-Nabi Saleh residents and international supporters stage a weekly protest every Friday against the illegal Israeli settlement and wall. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, April 14th, 2014 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is David Lang, Ken Jones, Robin Ryan, and myself. The producer is Joe Meyer. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. Look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hills can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Mike Klepfer.
And I'm Emily Young. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, hear the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. At 9, on Alternative Radio, biologist and professor Sandra Steingraber speaks on contamination without consent. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 a.m., on stage and studio, guest host Sarika Mehta talks with Dominican-American writer Julia Alvarez about her memoir, A Wedding in Haiti, The Story of a Friendship. And at 11:30, Joseph Gallivan hosts Art Focus, interviews with artists, curators, critics, and other art people. Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting this community radio station. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm. Just click on Donate Today.
And now stay tuned for a live interview conducted by KBOO reporters.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm talking with Paul Southwick, attorney at Davis Wright Tremaine. He's the attorney for George Fox University student Jace. Paul, welcome to KBOO and thanks.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Paul, I'd like you to kind of set the context here. What's the issue right now? Jace is a transgender student at George Fox University, and the issue certainly has to do with his housing options there.
Yes, Jace is a transgender student at George Fox, and he requested to be able to live in on-campus housing with some of his male friends, but the university denied that request.
And what was the basis of denying the request?
The university says that they have a policy of gender or sex-segregated housing, and that even though Jace is transgender, because he applied to the university initially as a female, he would have to continue living in female housing, even though he has socially, medically, and now legally transitioned to being a male.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you next. If anybody could go on some of the sites, K2, KGW, and actually see the story. But what is enlightening for me is some of the comments. Some of them, I would have to say, not too cognizant of the situation. But the more rational ones that I've read were they supported the university decision and were opposed to Jace's position based on the legal status of his gender. But you just said that he's considered a male now legally.
Yes, Jace began his legal transition when he changed his name to his current name, which is Jason, is a full version of his name with an E-N. He changed that about a year ago, and then he applied to have a legal gender change several weeks back, and that was granted by a Multnomah County judge last Friday.
So the university's position is that despite the fact that he's legally a male now, he enrolled at the university as a female, and that's not going to change no matter what?
Yeah, according to the university, there's pretty much nothing Jace can do for them to view him as a male in their eyes. They have continued to require him to be subject to their sex-segregated housing policy as a female rather than as a male. And Jace isn't asking them to abandon their sex or gender segregated housing policy. He's just asking them to be treated like every other male on campus. And unfortunately, the university is refusing to do that.
Now, the university, for this position, which again, you made clear that Jace is not opposing at all, they have the separate sex housing for females and males. The university, I know, cited Christian theology as the reasoning behind that position.
That's correct. The university has asserted that as a Christian community, they have a certain rules that everyone agrees to live by, and one of those is sex-segregated housing. And Jace does not disagree with that policy, but he is a man, and so he wants to be treated as a man according to that policy. And Jace himself is a Christian, and he doesn't see any incompatibility with being a Christian and also living with a transgender identity. And so for him, it's not a matter of having to violate any theological policy or view, nor has the university pointed to anything specific that Jace would be violating.
Okay, so it's not really a religious issue. Jace is fine with the university's position on separating sexes in housing, but where the issue comes up is that he wants to be recognized, which he is legally, as a male now, and be able to live in housing with other males at the college.
That's correct.
And I know that the university has said that they've compromised. They've offered him on-campus housing in a private apartment. That's something that Jace has not accepted, though, right?
That's correct. And the reason for that is that living alone is a very isolating experience, particularly for a transgender individual who is dealing with gender dysphoria and some of the depression and anxiety that goes with that. And so for Jace, it would not be in his best interest or in the interest of his mental health to live alone, separated from everyone else on campus. Plus, that kind of undermines one of the best benefits of being in a campus community is having roommates, is having those kinds of college experiences where you cook meals and you study late nights together. And it would really rob him of that.
And Jace actually has some male friends who he wants to room with, apparently. So these friends then, I'm sure, are very tolerant of Jace's transgender status, and that presents no problem.
That's correct. He has several friends that know him, that love him, accept him, treat him as one of the guys, and don't have any problem living with him. Moreover, Jace hasn't actually requested to live in one of the big male dorms with a bunch of strangers he doesn't know. He's actually requested to live on campus in an apartment or a suite, and where him and his roommates would have a private bathroom that they would share. And there are plenty of those on campus, and they are often reserved for incoming juniors like Jace.
Again, there would be no issues with people who he would be rooming with not accepting Jace as a roommate.
That's correct. He's not forcing himself on anyone.
Oh, so Paul, I wanted to ask next. We've just learned that the people he wants to room with are fine with it, and they're actually his friends, and are looking forward to rooming with him if the university relents or accepts that. Do you have any idea of what the general position is on campus among people who aren't administrators, say other students and the instructors and professors?
A lot of students have come out in support of Jace. They wore purple ribbons on campus on Thursday and Friday. Many students joined the rally that we had for Jace near campus on Sunday. So he's received quite a bit of support from his peers. That's one of the reasons why he wants to stay at George Fox. He's also felt a lot of support from faculty and even from some administrators. So it seems to be more of the higher level administration and board of trustees who aren't really listening to his story.
Now, the Board of Trustees and that higher administration, that's pretty much their final decision that Jace will not be allowed to room with other males on campus. But you recently then filed a complaint. In other words, the administration won't relent. So what's the next step there?
Yes, Jace exhausted all of his options with the university. His final appeal to the president, President Baker, was denied. And so we filed a Title IX sex discrimination complaint with the U.S. Department of Education. Now, that's not a lawsuit, but it is a formal complaint, and the university will process, the department will process that, and I will be in touch with them actually later this week, and they will ask a series of questions and decide whether or not to open up an investigation. If they do, then they will conduct interviews with administrators at George Fox, with Jace, and with the other decision makers and witnesses to his situation.
Now, I'm sure I'm not the only one listening now who, hears Title IX and they're thinking, equal athletic facilities for men and women on a college, but it apparently is more extensive than that.
Correct. That's what Title IX is most famous for, is in the sports context. However, what Title IX does is it requires all educational institutions that accept federal funds to not discriminate in the administration of their educational programs on the basis of sex. And so that includes when they discuss educational benefits or programs, that includes housing, on-campus housing. And so what Jace has alleged is that by denying him on-campus housing, the university has denied him an educational benefit, and they did so on the basis of his sex. And the Department of Education and Department of Justice have recently concluded that discrimination against transgender people is discrimination on the basis of sex.
And that was part of a recent decision then, conclusion?
It was part of a settlement in which a school district was not allowing a transgender student to access facilities consistent with the student's gender identity. And so as part of the settlement, which was publicly available, the departments made that conclusion and the student was allowed to access educational facilities consistent with their gender identity.
Oh, so actually, one of the questions I was going to ask you, Paul, was is there a precedent for this? In other words, with a university or an institution accepting federal funds, not allowing a transgender student access to facilities of their, their gender, their legal gender, and if the U.S. Department of Education has somehow resolved that.
Yes, and so that answers that question, and they were able to resolve it after an investigation. And so the hope of involving the Department of Education rather than rushing in to file a lawsuit is that the department can investigate and can encourage the university to do the right thing without having to go through the lengthy and expensive process of filing a lawsuit.
So if the Department of Education finds, as they did, precedent's been set, fines for Jace where they tell the university, he should have access to housing that other males have on campus, can the university legally deny Jace that privilege still?
The university could refuse to go along with the Department of Education's recommendation. Under those circumstances, the Department of Education could decide whether or not to recommend withholding federal funds from the university, or could instigate its own legal action against the university, or at that time, Jace could institute his own legal action.
Now what occurs to me immediately is there's been a lot of cases recently where, including one in Oregon with a bakery refusing to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding, where a private concern or a business, and this university is a private university, cites religious differences or religious issues, why they won't comply with what seems to be the law here. Is that something that George Fox would be able to do? Say it's our Christian theology, and despite what the Department of Education tells us to do, we have to do what's right by our religion?
Because the university accepts federal funding and because it is also generally open to the public, it does not limit enrollment to Christian students. Because of those two factors, among other factors, but particularly those two, the university is not able to discriminate on the basis of gender identity or other prohibited characteristics. That's under Title IX as well as under the Oregon Equality Act. Now, Title IX does have an exception for religious institutions when it comes to admissions. And so in admissions decisions, the university and other religious educational institutions may have an argument that they could deny enrollment to a student based on gender identity. However, once they've already admitted them, like they have Jace, then they need to provide equal educational opportunities.
So certainly not on a religious basis can they deny them that opportunity, but can they deny it because they're a private university, or is that kind of superseded by the fact that they're accepting federal funds?
Well, Title IX applies to any private educational institution that's accepting federal funds, and so being private does not remove them from their legal obligations under Title IX. Additionally, in Oregon, we have the Oregon Equality Act, and that applies to all public accommodations, and George Fox University would likely be considered a public accommodation because it offers educational services in exchange for tuition payments to the public generally.
Now, my next question, again, is I'm just curious, based on what you had mentioned about Title IX not applying to admissions, if Jace was transgendered at the time that he applied to George Fox, George Fox would have been fine with denying him admission to the college based on the fact that he was transgendered?
I don't think that the university would be able to do that. However, under Title IX, there is an exception for religious institutions under certain circumstances in which they do not have to admit students. But they, again, still have to meet the requirements of Title IX and have to demonstrate that they fit within that exception. However, the university has made clear that even now, fully knowing that Jace is transgender, they have no intention of expelling him or anything like that. In fact, they've said that they want him to stay at the school. So given that those are the facts of the case, Jace should be treated equally under those circumstances.
Do you have any assumptions or kind of predictions on how this will all play out?
My hope is that the university will listen to the George Fox University community, which is shown to have a lot of support for Jace, both from alumni, students, faculty members. In addition, Jace's mom's change.org petition has over 15,000 signatures in just a little over a week. And many of those signatures are from people from faith traditions. Many of them are from people who are Christian, who are Quaker, as the university is. And so it's really my hope and Jace's hope that the university will listen, hear his story, and treat him with the respect that he deserves.
And actually, my last question then, Paul, is you had mentioned some protests on campus and plus Jace's mom's petition, which is online. How can KBOO listeners then who support Jace in this issue voice their support?
So listeners who want to voice their support, they can write a email to the president of George Fox University. His email is on the George Fox website. It's letting them know your view on the issue, particularly if you are an alum of George Fox or you know someone who goes there or works there. Just letting the university know that you care about Jace, you care about this issue, and that you want them to change their mind. You can also go on the petition and sign the petition so that it can continue to generate more support for Jace.
And that petition is if they go to change.org and then just search for Jace, J-A-Y-C-E, or George Fox, they should be able to find that?
If you go on, the change.org petition, it's called George Fox University, Stop Denying My Transgender Son Appropriate On-Campus Housing. So if you search by George Fox University or transgender son and housing, it should come up.
Okay, and that hasn't been presented to the administrators yet, even though you said it has over 15,000 signatures?
We symbolically presented boxes full of signed petitions at our rally and protest on Sunday. In addition, every time someone signs the petition, it gets emailed to the administration.
Paul, thanks very much for talking with us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Paul Southwick of Davis Wright Tremaine. Paul's the attorney for George Fox University student Jace. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
Our jails and prisons have become overcrowded with people suffering from mental illness. Many people incarcerated are also addicted to drugs and alcohol. What treatment is being provided? Tune in to Prison Pipeline April 14th to hear Doyle Smith of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon talk about the need for treatment programs in our jails and prisons. That's Prison Pipeline April 14th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park on North Brandon and North Kilpatrick Streets in Portland.
The Earth Day 2014 theme, Reverse Migration, will focus on local culture and businesses. Over 100 sustainable businesses and organizations, including KBOO Community Radio, will participate in this event.
This celebration will also feature lots of live music and entertainment. Celebrate our planet at the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park. More information on this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio. I'm Jamie Partridge, your host. Tonight we'll be hearing from Mark Dimenstein, the new activist president of the American Postal Workers Union, as he addresses thousands of participants at the April 5th Labor Notes Conference in Chicago on defending and expanding public services.
But last week, the Wall Street Journal had an article that reported this, quote, U.S. corporate profits hit new highs last year. Driven by the tight lid, firms have kept on hiring and spending. After-tax corporate profits rose to $1.9 trillion in the first 3 months of the year. This is the reality. See, they're doing fine in this economic crisis, aren't they? And what about the rest of us, brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
Right? So, they got bailed out, and we got sold out. And the rest of us are left with the devastation of the unemployment, the underemployment, and our declining standards of living. Now, we're hearing a lot from politicians on high in this election year about addressing income inequality. But we're living in a moment where six members of the Walmart family have the accumulated wealth of 40% of the people of this country, or 110 million people. Six individuals. And GE, for those, anybody here ever worked for GE? I met somebody last night who has. A couple years ago, they did what? They made $14 billion in profit. And guess what they paid in taxes? It,
It's even better than zero.
Got a refund.
They got a refund. And it was just reported that the giant Caterpillar company did what? $2.4 billion in tax evasion, perfectly legal, offshore accounting scams. And of course, when they don't pay, who does? And when we don't have the tax base, it gets taken out of the public services and public sector in many cases as well. So we're facing, different than the corporate entities and their CEOs, we're facing a grim austerity. And an austerity that's couched behind the catchphrases of shared sacrifice. Hear that, plenty? Right, they share, somebody said it right. You want to come up too, brother? Brother, they share and we sacrifice. And I for one, don't want to share anything with these bastards. Share with Bill Gates, he gets a little, and we give
if you can kicking ass for that. How about that?
And the new but not so new Ryan budget proposals coming from the Republican side, the Democratic Party, White House appointed Simpson Bowles, they call it, I think, a deficit commission. It's an austerity commission. The bipartisan deals coming out of Congress all do what? They're all attacking Social Security, they're all attacking Medicare, they're all attacking food stamps, retirement benefits, unemployment benefits, all of it's under assault. And according to these very same powers, it's all our individual fault. If one of us is unemployed or tons of us are unemployed, it's because we just don't work hard enough or didn't try hard enough. If we can't get an education, or can't afford to get an education, it's our fault. If we lose our homes, it's our fault. If we don't have health care and can't afford health care, they want us to believe that it's our fault. And as long as workers and the working poor buy into that, and anyway, we are bombarded with it, as long as we buy that into that, we're going to be kept down, we're going to be kept divided, and we're going to be kept hopeless. If we don't deal with a system that creates the unemployment, that creates the homelessness, that doesn't provide health care as a human right, and so on and so forth. So throughout this austerity drive, and I think most people in the room know, it's not just in the United States. We've seen the Greek workers in the street and the French workers in the street fighting austerity. It's everywhere, because Wall Street's everywhere. But along with this drive is the war on the public good, public benefits, public rights, and public sector unions. After the capitalists got done just about destroying so many of our private sector unions, they've now unleashed their fury on public sector unions. And along with this drive, part of it is the privatization drive of public services. From education, public transportation, to public utilities, public hospitals, and public postal services. So I want to go into a little bit with you about the question of public postal services. I was shocked when I came into office. I had never read the existing law on the postal service. And when I read it, shocked may not be the right word. I was pleased and I was shocked. Because here's what it says when we talk about the public sector and public service. Because there's some parts of the public sector I don't want. I could do without the NSA spying on everybody. When it comes to serving the needs of the people, that's a different matter. So here's what the 1970 law says, still in effect. The United States Postal Service shall be operated as a basic and fundamental service provided to the people by the government of the United States. Authorized by the Constitution, created by act of Congress, and supported by the people. The Postal Service shall have as its basic function the obligation to provide postal services to bind the nation together. It shall provide prompt, reliable, and efficient services to patrons in all areas, and shall render postal services to all communities. How does that sound, brother? Not what's happening, is it? So, a few thoughts here. So the Postal Service does belong to the people. Privatization represents a looting of what belongs to the people. Privatization represents a transfer of wealth from decently paid union workers to the bosses and owners who thrive off non-union, non-living wage jobs. Postal jobs, unionized postal jobs, have been one of the few areas of true equal opportunity and equal pay for equal work. And that's part of what's under attack right now in the Postal Service. Privatization robs our communities of decent jobs and the positive impact decent jobs have on creating healthy communities. And privatization of postal services will never provide universal and uniform services, because the services will only be provided where a buck can be made. So the very essence of the postal system, to serve whoever we are, wherever we live, no matter our nationality, no matter where we work, no matter how old or young we are, no matter what color skin we have. That's one of the beauties of the public postal service. And that's what we'll be losing. Things would be made on whether somebody can make a buck. And to understand postal privatization, all you have to do is follow the money. The post office revenue is about $65 billion a year, with no taxpayer subsidies, money gathered off the people like us who use the postal system. So follow the money. That's what these privatizers are drooling over. And not to wear out the Wall Street Journal, but a couple years ago they had a major guest editorial called Junking the Junk Mail Post Office. And part of it said this, quote, entrepreneurs will see the demise of the United States